Made Victorious is the final part of our series, Why God Became Man. Be confident in Satan's coming defeat. Christmas marks an ending, the beginning of the end of the reign of Satan. Christ was raised from the dead to be the first fruits, and when he comes, it will be total victory. But just what is victory? Here's Pastor Seth.
We are finishing up a series, Why God Became Man. The title of today's message is Made Victorious. Made Victorious. Let's do a quick review of where we've been on this. Week one, why God became man, to be made alive. We were once spiritually dead. We were once personally dead, according to the Bible. We were once relationally dead. All we thought about, we were driven by ourselves and our own needs. And unless Jesus Christ changes that, we will be like that all our life. And that produces drama and heartache and all kinds of mess. When Christ comes into our life, he makes us alive. We are made alive, and he continues to make us more and more alive in our relationships and in our personal life. Second, he came to make us right. In one sense, we've been made right with God as far as our standing the day that we became Christians. Now, in addition to that, we are in a long, drawn-out process every day of our life of being made right in terms of our nature. That is a long, slow, tedious process, much more difficult than most of us have any awareness of. God is working around the clock every day in our lives to bring that about, and one of his favorite things to do is problems to do that. Third, to be made honorable. Sin makes us dishonorable before God. The Bible says that when the people worshipped idols, they became worthless. Worthless idols, they became worthless. We find ourselves trying to be people of honor. We find ourselves beating ourselves in the back and wondering why we're such a screw-up and how are we ever going to figure out what my life is all about and the meaning of life. And God puts a story in our hearts, his story, where we become honorable in his story. He makes us honorable through the cross, and then in the course of our life, day by day, over the many years, he continues to form us more and more into Christ, where we honor him and people have a chance to see something of who Christ is through our lives. Then fourth, to be made happy, and there should be an asterisk after that word happy, because it's not, God didn't make us happy like going to Disneyland makes you happy. This is more about joy and the discovery of what joy is. Joy is not the same as going to a football game like the USC game and watching them win. That's happiness. But joy is something very different. It's something that happens down in our hearts. It's much more of a settled satisfaction of knowing that we're finally in a right relationship with God. We're finally in the place we're supposed to be. We're finally becoming the people that we're supposed to be. We can see God at work in our lives. God begins to use our lives to affect other people. All of those things bring a sense of joy. But it's more of an inward, quiet sense of satisfaction and really more of a sense of gratitude than anything else. Now, today what I'd like to look at is made victorious. And I hesitate to even use this title because it sort of infers a kind of Christianity that I don't believe in. There is one kind of Christianity you'll find on Christian radio that once you become a Christian, that all of life is grand for the most part. And if you just follow what the Bible says, then won't life just be peachy keen? Well, the Bible gives indication that sometimes that happens, but it also gives lots of indication that there are a lot of other times that's not how it works. In my own life, rather than feeling victorious, it's very easy for me to feel defeated. Rather than thinking I'm making such great progress for the Lord, sometimes it seems like I'm just stuck in a swamp, and the progress I'm making is oh so slow, just slogging along. Rather than feeling like a spiritual victor, it seems to me like I often feel like a spiritual failure. Instead of being victorious, it seems like I'm more often defeated. What does it mean that we've been made victorious? What does that mean? Yesterday, I was sort of reminded of this. I did a little soccer camp for several of our families on our team and invited all the siblings to come. And so we had about an hour of fun and practice and games and stuff like that. And then I had bought 2 quarts of my son's homemade ice cream, cookies and cream ice cream. And we had a make-your-own Sundays thing for these little 6 and 7-year-olds and the siblings, you know, sprinkles and gummy bears and M&Ms. And I forgot the hot fudge. I left it at home. I wasn't all that disappointed that I left it at home. Now, I'm out on the field, and a couple dads are out there watching as I'm doing my thing with the kids at soccer and the siblings and stuff like that. And then we go to sit down, and then one of the dads is quite he's very verbal, and he's highly opinionated, and I know he means well, which keeps me tracking with him. But sometimes he can be one of these people who are just sort of overbearing and overwhelming. When we got all done, I was walking my stuff back to the car, and one of the other dads was there helping me to carry my stuff back, and he said, "You know, Seth, I got to tell you are one patient man." And I was really surprised by that. I really didn't know. Was he talking about being on the field with all those kids for an hour? Was he talking about just being with the adults? And maybe then I thought, well, I think he's thinking about all that. And then my next thought went to, I haven't always been that way. And I told him, I said, when I was in college, I had a ferocious, out-of-control temper. And he looked at me like he was could hardly tell, are you the same person? I said, now that's 40 years ago. But God's done a lot of work in my life in this area. But it's not the kind of work that just suddenly I woke up and had a particular couple verses that thought, okay, now I got it. Now I'm good to go. Wasn't like that at all. It has been one long, slow, steady climb. But that climb, sometimes I'm making progress, and sometimes it feels like I'm falling right back to where I started. And it's making progress again, and sometimes it feels like I'm getting right back to where I started. Now, what I assume is happening is that part of the process of becoming victorious is being defeated. And instead of being defeated in my spirit about that, to come to a place where I hate sin and I hate self-centeredness more than I have before. That's the road to being victorious. It's such a paradox. It often feels like defeat, but it's the road to victory. It's the road to change. Okay, now, let's look at a few verses in our handout. 1 John 3:8 is our main verse for this week. The reason the Son of God appeared, Christmas message here, was to destroy the works of the devil. The past works of the devil, the current works of the devil, and the works of the devil that he's wanting to do in your life on a go-forward basis. And 1 John 4:4, you dear children, he's talking to Christians now, are from God and have overcome them. Because the one in you, meaning Christ, is greater than the one who is in the world, meaning Satan. So it's not just that Jesus Christ came to destroy the works of the devil, 1 John 3:8, but he also came to do that in your life. And for you to see victory over Satan, where in the past Satan has been victorious over you. Our enemy, who is our enemy? 1 Peter 5:8. Peter says, be sober. Now, he's not talking to alcoholics here. The idea is be sober-minded. You need to be serious about something here. Don't let this one slip by. Be watchful. And the idea is every day, watchful through the course of every day. Your adversary, not just some little creature with horns and a red face and a pitchfork. Your adversary, the enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion. You ever see some of those History Channel or Discovery Channel with the lion lurking in the underbrush, stalking his prey? That's the picture here that Peter gives us of Satan. Around like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour. We have somebody that would like to gobble you up and all that you hold dear and the people you hold dear to destroy. Revelation 9:11 says, "They have as king over them the angel of the bottomless pit. His name in Hebrew is Abaddon, and in Greek he is called Apollyon." Apollyon means the destroyer. Destroyer. Now, sometimes that destruction happens in very overt ways that you can read about in the newspaper and hear on the news. But most of the time, it seems to me that the destroyer's work is done much more subtly. He's a whisperer. You will find yourself thinking that you're thinking to yourself, thought like, "I don't know if anybody at that church really cares about me. Why does that person always seem to turn the conversation to themselves? Or, I don't know if I'm really ever going to be a very good Christian. It seems like I'm just a constant screw-up." Now, those may be your thoughts. But if they are, somebody else is pouring some gasoline on those thoughts and helping to light a fire with those thoughts. So that those thoughts get burned into your identity, into your heart, to where you end up becoming that person defined by those beliefs instead of defined by the beliefs that God has for us. That's his destruction. Revelation 12:10, "I heard a loud voice in heaven saying, 'Now have come the salvation and power and kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ. For the accuser of our brothers,'" that's another name for Satan, "'the accuser of our brothers, who accuses them before our God day and night, has been hurled down.'" Now, what kind of work is going on here? We call this in our culture drama. Drama. Somebody says something, and what you think of is something like this: "He meant to hurt me. She meant to hurt me." You draw the worst possible conclusion of what somebody did. Or you hear something like, "Man, that person, they're just driven by self." And you sort of dismiss whatever it is they're doing. Again, the worst possible motivation for something. Or you find yourself just being suspicious regularly. Or critical in your thoughts regularly. Or the life of the relationship that you have slowly draining out of you, out of the relationship. Or distance slowly being created between you and people you care about. This is the accuser of the brethren. This is the kind of work that Satan does, our enemy, to try to destroy us. On the inside of your handout, we have some good news. And that is Satan's coming defeat. In 1 John 3:8, the reason the Son of God appeared was to destroy the works of the devil. Now, Christmas is always a fun time for me. But when you normally think about Christian from the Bible's point of view, what we normally think about is it's at the beginning of God becoming man, the beginning of the incarnation, the beginning of the ministry that Jesus is going to have, and the ultimate defeat of Satan. And those things are always true as well. But Christmas is always about an ending. It's also about an ending. Is that the reign of Satan here, the prince of darkness on this earth, the end has begun. It's just the beginning of the ending, but the end is begun. I am a World War II buff. One of my favorite times in World War II is D-Day. June 6, 1944, Eisenhower gave the okay, and 150,000 troops advanced on a little part of France called Normandy. Thousands of paratroopers were paratrooped in the night before. Their job was to close up roads, take bridges, and try to keep Hitler's army, Rommel's Panzer Division especially, from reinforcing other parts of Normandy, which for the most part they did. And then those troops hit the beaches early morning, 5 different beaches at Normandy. Now, for a while, all those guys could do was they made it out of the landing crafts. Not all of them did. Some of them drowned out there. Some of them were killed in their landing craft, but some made it actually to the beach. Some of those guys were killed. Some of those made it to a wall at the foot of the beach. And there's hills coming up, like you can imagine down here at Newport or Corona Del Mar Hills, where the enemy's up on the hills. The objective was to create a beachhead. If at the end of the day, those soldiers still stuck down there at the foot of the beach, they're going to get driven off. Those guys slowly made their way up those hills. The Rangers scaled about 100-foot cliffs, straight up with ropes. And they took those hills. A beachhead was established. More ships came in. Tanks were able to be unloaded. Army supplies, ammunition, hospital equipment, food. Beachhead was secured, and then moved inland. Now, that was January 6, 1944. You know what happened on May 7th, 1945? They call it VE Day. Victory Over Europe Day. That's only 11 months and one day later. But it all started, the most important day was D-Day, when a beachhead was established. Now, that's Christmas. A beachhead was established when that little baby was born. Now, the scriptures declare that Satan was not happy about this, and there are sort of two parallel stories that go on. The one we're more familiar with is Herod, who found out about this king of the Jews and wanted to do him in and had every baby boy under 2 years old killed in Bethlehem. But the scriptures also describe sort of a mysterious thing of Satan going behind the scenes and trying to destroy the baby, the helpless little baby of Joseph and Mary, but he was stopped from doing so. It's a pretty amazing story. Satan's coming defeat was begun that day. Next, Satan will be driven out. Now, it's interesting to me how this happens. Adam and Eve had an opportunity when they were, as people, created holy and living in the Garden of Eden. They had an opportunity when Satan came to tempt them to do something that we rarely think about. And that is, they could have shamed him, could have shamed Satan. They could have defeated him in his temptation. They could have said, "You're a moron. You had everything in heaven that you could have been there with God who loves you, and you rebel just because of your pride and ego, and now you're coming to try to draw us into that same kind of foolishness and wickedness? No thanks." They could have said that, and Satan could have been rightfully shamed by their obedience, but that didn't happen. What could have happened was something like a weaker human being like Adam and Eve, though tempted by Satan, could have still obeyed. Whereas Satan, who was a far stronger creature, not tempted by anyone, still disobeyed himself and made a complete and utter fool of himself. But that didn't happen. Adam and Eve were tempted by Satan. They took the bait. And from that time on, Satan has been the prince of the power of the air of this world, the prince of darkness in our land. But in John 12, Jesus says, that time is almost over. Now is the time for judgment on this world. The prince of this world will be driven out. Now, how does that happen? How is Satan going to be driven out of this world? Well, Jesus tells us the next step of this in the very next verse, verse 32. When I am lifted up from the earth, I will draw all men to myself. And here the idea of being lifted up, he's referring to the cross. When they nail me to that piece of wood and they lift that cross and they lift me up, that's going to be the time at which Satan is going to start to be defeated from this world. The little phrase, draw all men to myself, is not people are going to be so enamored with me when they see me dying on the cross. They're just going to think, oh, he's loved me so much and he sacrificed. That's not what that word means. The word draw there means is a picture of this. People are running away from God as quickly as they can to want to do their own thing. And Jesus Christ is reaching out and grabs us by the shirt collar or the nape of the neck and drags some of us back kicking and screaming, so to speak, to discover himself. It's not like we're all just a bunch of just wonderful spiritual clients. We're all rebels at heart. But this is going to happen. The cross is going to happen, and it's going to begin to draw us to himself. Now, one of the questions that people ask is about, why did it take a baby? Why did Jesus have to become fully human? I'm going to use the word, he became a man, meaning capital M man, but still fully man. Capital M man, meaning he didn't sin and he didn't disobey. He fully obeyed God, different from us being men. Why did that have to happen? Why couldn't God have just said, wave a magic wand and say, I'm going to forgive people who will simply come to me? And the reason is, nobody would. Not a single soul. It had to be something else that would grab the attention of people. Paul says in Galatians 4:4, when the time had fully come, God sent his son, born of a woman, born under the law. Now what he's going to describe here is a contrast, and then Paul does this again in 1 Corinthians 15, between what Adam did and contrast that with what Christ did. Adam disobeyed. Christ obeyed. Adam sinned against God. Jesus Christ was holy towards God. Adam torpedoed all of our sinful human nature, making that a part of who we are. All of our inclinations are towards ourself first. Jesus came to transform our human nature. Through Adam's work, spiritual death became a part and parcel of life. We just don't care all that much about God. Maybe a little bit, but not all that much. That's spiritual death. Whereas what Jesus came to do was to give us spiritual rebirth and then spiritual life. Through Adam was brought forth physical death, and through Jesus was brought forth physical life and resurrection. 1 Corinthians 15, Paul continues the same idea. Christ has indeed been raised from the dead, the first fruits of those who have fallen asleep. Since death came through a man, again, an Adam and Jesus comparison and contrast. Since death came through a man, the resurrection of the dead comes also through a man. And here he means Jesus Christ, capital M, man. As in Adam all die, so in Christ all will be made alive. But each in his own turn. Christ the first fruits, then when he comes, those who belong to him. Then the end will come when he hands over the kingdom to God the Father after he has destroyed all dominion, authority, and power. He must reign until he has put all of Satan's enemies under his feet. Now, what he's saying is something like this. Is there was a time when Satan rebelled against God out of his own pride and ego, and he took off out of heaven, he was hurled out, and he was left here, and he came to man, and he defeated us. And every person since has had a sin nature. We are separated from God. That's our natural state of affairs, our natural nature. Now, what would happen if God just sort of waved his wand and forgave people? And let's assume that people saw that wand and they realized the meaning of it and they said, oh, my gosh, I'm lost. But God wants to save me. Let's say that would happen. Now, what would Satan think? What Satan might think is, well, you got him in the long run, but I got him in the short run. I was the victor. And in some ways, that's still on my record. I'm the victor. Now, from God's point of view, I don't think God wants Satan to think that way. And he certainly doesn't want us to think that way about ourselves or about Satan as victorious. What does it mean for Satan to be defeated? Years ago, when I was in high school, I was not all that attendant to my father's advice. And one of the things that he had tried to give me advice on was driving. When it's rainy in Houston, the roads get slick. And I was driving one day, just making a left-hand turn. I got in the left-hand turn lane, and I got too close to the lady in front of me. I put on the brakes and skidded into the back of her car. Thankfully, we're not going very fast. We got out, and we exchanged phone numbers and information. And I told her it was my fault, and it was my fault, and that I would pay for it. Now, I had no idea how I was going to pay for it. I had a part-time job, but I wasn't making very much money. And I figured this is going to be a lot of money. So I called the lady, told her, I told my dad, and I'm going to get an estimate. And I was working more hours up at this little drugstore when I was in high school. And I was working furiously. Of all things, you know what I was doing at this drugstore? I was a cook. I was the only cook at this drugstore. Hamburgers and malts and shakes and, you know, kind of a deli kind of thing. That's pretty funny. You know, eventually that place went out of business. Maybe there's a connection there. Hadn't really thought about that before. Now, when I got home, I told my father about that. I already knew what he was going to say. Well, you're going to pay for it. Now, he could have paid for it. He could have paid for that very easily. Could have written the check right then. I suspect that what he did was he called the lady and told her that he was guaranteeing payment, but it was going to take his son a while to work and save up the money to pay her. That's what I suspect my father did, knowing him. But I didn't know it at the time, and so I was working a lot of hours and finally got the money together, and I went over to her house and gave her a check. Now think about this. What would have happened to me? What would have been the effect on me if I had said, Dad, could you just write a check? I don't have that kind of money. I can't do that. Would you just take care of it? Wave your magic wand and make it disappear. What effect would that have had on me? What would I have thought? Now, he didn't do that. Instead, he made me work my hours, earn the money, and go over there and hand the lady a check. What effect did that have on me? That was far better for me than the first one. That's sort of like what's being described here between God becoming a man and man defeating Satan, rather than God just waving his magic wand and suddenly we're free. In a few days, we have three members of our church who will be watching the Rose Bowl. They're Oregon Duck fans. Oregon is a 9-point favorite over Florida State, which is heavy favorites to win. They're likely going to be in the championship game, probably against Alabama, who's also a heavy favorite against Ohio State. Now, Oregon is ranked second in the country, and they probably would have been ranked first in the country had not they lost one game to Arizona. And it's a game they could argue they probably shouldn't have lost. Oregon is a very, very strong team. But let's say, what would have happened if Oregon had finished out its season and there was no Pac-12 championship game and they'd just been invited to the tournament, the four-team tournament, and let's say they beat Florida State and let's say they beat Alabama or Ohio State and they win the national championship. They're really happy about that, as they should be. But what would the Arizona fans and team say? We beat those guys. We took them down. We're the only team to do it. Why, they would be gloating and happy about that and sort of rubbing it in their face. We beat you guys. Except for one thing. The Pac-12 instituted a championship game, and at the end of the season, about a month or so ago, Oregon had a chance to meet Arizona a second time. And this time, Oregon put Arizona in the ground. I mean, they destroyed these guys. It wasn't even close. It was so bad they let the women and kids out at halftime. Rated R for violence. Sorry, kids. We don't want you to see this. Not going to be pretty. Now, let's say Oregon goes ahead and wins the national championship. I don't think you're going to hear that much from the Arizona fans after the whipping that they took at the hands of Oregon. That's something what Paul is arguing here. And what God argues here and why Jesus came to earth, because a man, capital M, came to defeat Satan where Satan once defeated man. You follow this? All the gloating that Satan could do if he wanted to is going to be destroyed. 1 John 3:8 again, the reason the Son of God appeared was to destroy the works of the devil. There was a mission trip that Jesus sent the disciples out on. And the beginning of the downfall of Satan is described in this mission trip. They come back from this little mission trip, and he tells these guys, I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven. Now, these are just ordinary guys. who are trying to take the mission of Christ, the love of Christ, the light of Christ to the people that are in a dark world. And from Jesus' point of view, there's something going on in the spiritual realm that's pretty amazing. Satan is hightailing it. He says, I've given you authority, meaning the disciples, to trample on snakes and scorpions. Now, he's not talking about physical scorpions and snakes. You know, sometimes you see this little church in Tennessee who just missed the complete point of this verse. Scorpion and snakes are allegorical pictures of what Satan and his demons are like. They're nasty and they're vile and nobody wants anything to do with them. I've given you authority to trample on. And here he's talking about victory over Satan. What does it mean to be victorious? To trample on, to overcome all the power of the enemy, nothing will harm you. Now, it's not that we don't have sickness and disease and people still die. What he's talking about is nothing will harm your spiritual relationship with God and need not harm your relationships with people. What I'm trying to come to do in your life is to give you victory in these arenas. On the back of your handout, what is victory? What does victory look like? Well, we've looked at a few of these. To be made right, to be made alive, to be made honorable, to be made joyful, and all those things are still in process. But ultimately, we come to these verses in Galatians 5:13. This is the center of the point, the tip of the spear. You are called to freedom, brothers, only do not use your freedom as an opportunity for the flesh, but through love be servants of one another. Through love, be servants of one another. Not self-centered, not turned in on ourselves, outward focused. The whole law is fulfilled in one word. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. Give the same amount of attention to the people in your life that you already give to yourself. That's the idea. But if you bite and devour one another, take heed that you are not consumed by one another. I read that verse and I think about the old Pac-Man game. Little guys going along, munching up those little dots. Yeah, that's what he's describing us as. If we won't let Jesus Christ be the Lord of our life, we're going to do that to the people in our lives. Gobble up the little dots in their life. Unstoppable. Now, what would motivate Jesus to come? Why would he come? Except to love us. That's one thing we usually think of. But he could also see a people where his love would be in us. And he could envision a day where his love would be streaming through us, out to other people. And there's a kind of people who are created, who are formed, who are enjoying that kind of Trinitarian love with one another. Dear friends, John says, let us love one another. Love comes from God. Everyone who loves has been born of God and knows God. Whoever does not love does not know God, because God is love. This is how God showed his love among us. He sent his one and only Son into the world that we might live through him. That's the Christmas message. Sent his one and only Son into the world that we might live through him. This is love, not that we love God, that he loved us and sent his Son as an atoning sacrifice for our sin. About 150 years ago, there was a pastor in New England. I was walking through their little town, and he came across a boy walking down with a bird cage, three little birds in it. And the little birds in there were terrified. The little boy had one of those little impish grins on his face like he was up to no good, and the pastor said to him, what are you going to do with those birds? He said, I'm going to have fun with those birds. He said, I'm going to tease them, I'm going to start plucking out their feathers, and I'm going to start to get them to fight with one another inside that bird cage. Huh. Well, after a while, you're going to get bored of that. Then what are you going to do? The little boy said, oh, that's easy. We got cats, and our cats love little birds. They'll kill them and eat them. Pastor shook his head. He said, son, how much would you take for that cage and those birds? The little boy said, what? You're not not going to pay me for those birds in that cage. Those birds are worthless. They're just little field birds. They can't sing. They're nothing to look at. They're ugly little birds. They're of no use at all. How much would you take for them? Little boy saw his opportunity. He said, $10. Pastor reached into his pocket, pulled out $10, gave the money. The kid no longer had his money. Then he took off. The pastor has a bird cage with three birds in it. He walks down an alley out into just outside into one of the fields, and there's a tree up close. And he goes to the bird cage. He lifts it up and he opens the door. And then he just was able to sort of scooch all three of the little birds out, and they made their way to freedom up in the tree. Then the pastor on Sunday told this story. There was a conversation one day between Jesus and Satan. Satan comes to Jesus and he says, you see what I got? Jesus says, what? He said, I set a trap for your people. Just the right bait that I knew they would take. And they took it. And now I've got them. I've got them in my cage. What are you going to do with them? Oh, I'm going to have fun with them. I'm going to make sure they get angry with each other. They fight. Argue with each other. They're suspicious of each other. They hurt each other. I'm going to teach them to build bullets and bombs and do great destruction. But the greatest thing is I'm going to watch them die slow deaths through depression and anger and fear and worry. Huh. Well, what are you going to do after that with them? He said, when I'm done with them, then I'm going to kill them. Every one of them. Jesus said, how much would you take for them? Satan said, you don't mean that. You don't want that group of people. They could care less about you. They don't want anything to do with you or your ways. You buy them, they'll spit in your face. They won't give you the time of day. They'll just be suspicious of you for the most part, especially when you don't do the things that they think you ought to do. And finally, when things get so bad, they'll kill you. Jesus nodded. He said, how much? Satan realized he had an opportunity. And he said, your blood. And your tears. And your life. To which Jesus said, done. This is the Christmas story. Let's pray together. You promise that one day we will reign with you eternally. And we look forward to that day with great longing. There are a lot of times in this life now where it seems like we just... We keep being spiritual screw-ups and spiritual defeats. Sometimes it's discouraging trying to be a Christian. And yet you're using even those times to get us to hate sin, to hate the self-centered life of which we are so naturally attuned to. And through that hatred of sin, through a holy disgust, you change our very nature to want to be more like your son, who is so different than we are. We long for that. We ask you to continue your good work in that. However you can speed up that process, we're all for. We know that however things look on any given day, that one day we will stand victorious.